2009 for the White Ribbon. Second place prize went to Matteo Garrone's Italian satire, Reality, while Ken Loach's whiskey-tasting comedy, The Angel's Share, won third place. The 12-day festival, which wrapped up Sunday, also saw plenty of glamour, with stars like Brad Pitt and Nicole Kidman appearing both on screen and on the red carpet. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News.
For tennis fans, Roger Federer has tied Jimmy Connors' Open-era record of 233 Grand Slam match wins. He did so when he beat Tobias Kamke of Germany in the first round of the French Open. The 30-year-old Federer is trying to become one of the oldest players to win a Grand Slam tournament. I'm Jim Howard, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from America's Natural Gas Alliance, supporting domestic energy while working to protect the environment. Learn more at anga.us.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. It's hour two of the show. I'm David Inge. Harriet Williamson is our producer. The following program comes from the Focus archive, so that means that for the next hour, we will not be taking your calls. 200,000 African-American soldiers were sent to Europe to fight in World War I. Historian Adrian Lentz Smith says that experience gave many black people their first taste of life outside of the American racial system. She says that it led them to imagine a different world, one that they worked to make real when they returned home from the war. This morning, in this hour of Focus 580, we'll talk about some of the ways that World War I shaped the civil rights movement in the United States, and that is one of the themes of the book that we'll be talking about here this morning. The title of the book is Freedom Struggles, African Americans and World War I. It's published by the Harvard University Press, and the author is our guest, Adrian Lentz Smith. She is Assistant Professor of History at Duke University, and we're pleased that she could spend some time with us to talk about the book. Well, Professor Lentz Smith, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
We certainly appreciate it. I want to have you talk just to start here maybe about the larger kind of theme here of the book. Can you, in fact, draw connections between the experience of black soldiers in the war and perhaps also feelings of the black community in the United States, so both the people who went to fight and the people who are here at home? Can you draw connections between that experience and the struggle for civil rights as it unfolded then in the years after World War I?
I think you can, quite certainly. I mean, I think that you can draw links between African-American military service and the ongoing black freedom struggle from the American Revolution all the way forward, right? And certainly you can see in the Civil War the ways in which African-Americans, both in the Union Army and as slaves looking forward to emancipation, made that war a war over slavery, and the ways in which African-Americans after that carried that sense of their military service, their sort of earned citizenship, their commitment to the American nation through political traditions that took them out of Reconstruction and into the age of Jim Crow. And so people have that sort of in their heads and sort of in their sort of understandings of community and their place in America, even going into World War I. I think what happens with World War I and with military service, both the 200,000 that you mentioned who go overseas and the nearly 200,000 more who serve stateside back in the United States, is that they come to understand that they're going to have to do more in order to gain full citizenship rights, that they've given America everything that they have, their lives, their health, their loyalty, and they've only gotten limited recompense for that giving. And the difficulty of World War I and the resistance of white Americans to granting them full citizenships after their sort of loyal service in World War I mobilizes, I'd say, an entire cohort of people to push for full citizenship rights after after the war.
Well, before that point, before World War One, was there some kind of tradition of in among African Americans of looking at military service as being a something that one could do to establish your Americanness and your worthiness of citizenship, of the right to participate in politics, the right to vote, equal access, all those sorts of things?
There was. And it was something that was incredibly meaningful within African-American communities, but which only had limited payoff outside of African-American communities. So for African-Americans amongst one another, military service was one of these sort of defining aspects of citizenship, of manhood, of belonging. But it always met with resistance from people committed to Jim Crow, white Americans committed to Jim Crow, who wanted to degrade or to belittle that service. But even so, you see these posters as people are mobilizing for World War One from Crispus Attucks, one of the first people to die, you know, in the Boston Massacre before the American Revolution, from Crispus Attucks to Carrizal, which was a location of a fight in the sort of against the Mexicans with Pancho Villa in the Mexican Revolution in 1916. We have done our bit. So African Americans are drawing this line of service and saying, "Hey, we've been here and we've done this and we matter, and you will give us our citizenship because we have been loyal Americans for centuries now." They stop believing that that's going to happen with World War One, and that's sort of the story of the book in a lot of ways, the ways in which that belief that one can earn citizenship becomes a determination to demand citizenship, because they realize that no matter what they do to prove themselves worthy, it won't ever be enough.
The attitude of the military, was it that they welcomed black soldiers, or was it more the case that they felt that they absolutely had to have them because they needed people, and that they took them with whatever reluctance that came along with that?
Well, it depended sort of from military figure to military figure. Wilson had instituted a draft, which was controversial in its own right, but that draft was locally administered by draft boards. And what you see, particularly in the South, is that in one town, a draft board would refuse to draft African Americans because they didn't want to bestow on them the honor of military service. In another town, the white people who ran the local draft board would think, well, we don't want our children going to the army. Let's send the black community into the army. So it's, you know, there's sort of different expressions of prejudice and different expressions of commitment to the war in its own way from place to place. For the people who were drafted, or the few that enlisted, of nearly 400,000, only 40,000 men were made into combat troops. So only 40,000 people actually fought or almost saw fighting. The other, the vast majority of African Americans in the Army were used as laborers. And that was indicative of the military's sense of their capacity. And that was something that's sort of pseudoscientific, based on racial theory and certain kinds of IQ tests that were very skewed and what have you. But they thought that African Americans, by nature and inclination, were much better laborers than they were warriors. And in fact, there were military officials who just referred to them as laborers in uniform and used them as such.
Did all of the black men that went into the military, did they all receive combat training?
Oh, no. And in fact, many if you look at the memoirs of some of the guys who went to the – there was a segregated officers training camp that the NAACP ended up pushing for even though it was segregated because they thought if it's the choice between a segregated camp or no officers, we're going to go with the camp. But the memoirs of many of the guys, many of them, most of them college educated, who write about their experience in camp. They say this is just a joke. This is ridiculous. They're not really training us for much of anything. And those same sort of memoirs written when they go overseas and they're supposed to be continuing their training and preparing for battle is the same thing. We're just marching around in circles. They aren't teaching us to do anything. And it's particularly – they're particularly bitter because they knew that – what would eventually happen, which is that these poorly trained troops would then fail and the military authorities would blame, again, the innate incapacity of black officers to lead and demote them or send them to be in charge of labor battalions, which is just what happened. Most of the people who were drafted were just sent to be longshoremen or to build roads or to build buildings or railroads or what have you, and not given combat training at all.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Adrienne Lent-Smith. She is assistant professor of history at Duke University and is the author of the book Freedom Struggles, African Americans and World War One. It's published by the Harvard University Press. We do have a caller. Certainly other people are welcome to get involved in the conversation. First up here, we have someone in Chicago. We'll go right there to Chicago on our toll-free line, line number four. Hello.
Good morning, everyone. I find the subject, as an African-American myself, I find this very interesting because I don't think people realize that this story actually goes back to the Revolutionary War when some of the freed states wanted to enlist Africans for the war for the Continental Army, and Washington wasn't too thrilled with that. Now, remember, this was a Southerner, and he did have slaves, and he wasn't too thrilled with that. But then Lord Dunsmore, who commanded the English in Virginia, issued a proclamation and said that all of those people known as slaves who leave their masters and who join the king's forces to put down the rebellion will be emancipated at the end of the war. He beat Lincoln by about 80 years. But anyway, this caused a number of blacks to leave the plantation and join the English army, and then Washington accepted it. In fact, he had an integrated army. You wouldn't see another army like that until the Korean War, and I'd like to know your comment on that.
Well, you're exactly right, and I think it points to this even bigger sort of issue that the way in which the story of African Americans in World War One and the way the story of the black freedom struggle writ large is actually the story of American democracy, right? And sort of what that means and who has defined it. And thinking about Lord Dunmore's proclamation and the attempt to use people of color, enslaved and otherwise, on both sides, makes me think of that great speech by Frederick Douglass a little under a century later, where he says, what does the 4th of July mean to me, right? As a black man whose people are still held in captivity, what should the 4th of July mean? And there are a couple of ways of answering that question, and sort of you can follow the histories and see the ways in which people have answered that question.
When it comes to the military, it seems like we take two steps forward, three steps back. You look at Roosevelt dealing with the civil rights leaders at the time and promising to set up an air unit. Of course, eventually he did, but he had to be sort of prodded into doing it. He wasn't too crazy about doing it. When you talk about civil rights, a lot of people like to think about Roosevelt. They like to think about Kennedy. Now, John Kennedy tried, but you got to remember Roosevelt, for instance, although he made a number of wonderful speeches about freedom and democracy and all the rest of it, this man did not support anti-lynching laws. He also locked up 110,000 people without a trial or anything else. The real president who did anything about it at that time would be Harry Truman.
Which is a surprise, actually, in some ways, when you think about
both of the presidents that we've had in this century, and I thought about myself, both of them were from the South. Harry Truman, Missouri, Lyndon Johnson, Texas. Right. And Lyndon Johnson actually said that He never anticipated, I don't anticipate now or ever being in favor of any civil rights bill. But yet 8 years later after he signed that, said that, he signed the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act.
I think when we think about Roosevelt, we have to give props to Eleanor Roosevelt, who
I think was the conscience,
yeah. The sort of moral conscience of the Roosevelt administration.
Yeah, not that it did any good, but she did her best.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much for taking a close meeting.
Well, other questions, comments are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455, and by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Among African-Americans, and particularly people who wrote about, thought about, talked about politics, what was the opinion of the involvement by America generally in the war? I mean, did they think that it was something that America should be doing, or did they have mixed feelings about it?
I think in the beginning before the U.S. declared war, there were mixed feelings. And in fact, when Europe went to war in 1914, back when everyone thought that it would be a short war, you actually see this not glee, but a sense of a sort of public sense of moral superiority, right? So Booker T. Washington, for example, sent a note, I think, to Andrew Carnegie. I can't remember who it was, but basically saying, and I'm sitting here watching those heathens over there in Europe, you know, have their tribal fights among themselves, right? So it's turning the discourse of civilization and savagery on its head. And Du Bois himself wrote, W.E.B. Du Bois, wrote this wonderful essay in 1915 about the African roots of the war, saying that this is a war about imperialism and imperial rivalries, spurred by the attempt of various European nations to cut the continent of Africa up into various pieces. When the U.S. joined in 1917, a lot of those criticisms about the foolishness of the war or the motivations for getting at the war largely fell away among mainstream African Americans, but not solely. You can think about someone like A. Philip Randolph, who would go on to be the organizer of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and then of the March on Washington movement during World War II, who in 1917 was a young immigrant from Florida living in New York and a socialist who was avowedly pacifist and a deep critic of Woodrow Wilson's because of the way that Woodrow Wilson had helped to embed Jim Crow in Washington, D.C., and who thought that there was something fundamentally absurd and immoral about the war and ridiculous about the idea of African-American participation in it.
Let us take another call here from someone where we are in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Yes, Professor, I'd just like you to clarify whether what I heard is true or not. I once heard that the few African Americans who were allowed to engage in combat in World War One weren't necessarily a member of the U.S. Armed Forces, but were sort of delegated to the French and fought as members of the French Legion. Is that true or not?
That's sort of true. So there were a few sets of people who fought as combat troops. There were the people who made their way to Europe and fought as part of either British or French combat forces, the most famous of whom is Eugene Bullard, who was a pilot. He flew with the French Foreign Legion. And in fact, when America joined the war, he offered to come back and fly with the U.S. and was turned down. Then there was the 92nd Division of combat troops who fought as part of the U.S. Army. You know, so the U.S. sent over the 92nd and the 93rd Division. 92nd stayed with the U.S. American Expeditionary Forces. The 93rd was given over to the French and integrated, became part of the French Army for all intents and purposes, practically and administratively, for the duration of the war, because the French were so woefully short of men. And so that division, the combat troops in the 93rd Division, had a very different experience than those in the 92nd, because they were contained within a different country's military and a sort of a country with a different understanding of race and nation and sort of racial hierarchy.
Thank you, Professor.
All right. Thank you for the call. Again, questions welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I wonder, can you talk about what happened here before maybe we talk some more about the experiences in Europe? What happened here stateside and the kind of friction that took place between whites and black soldiers?
Well, there was a lot of friction, both overseas and stateside. And the two stories that I really draw out in the book, one, because the riot in Houston in 1917, is where I began when I began this project, because at the time I was so struck by it. But in that instance, there were members of the regular army, so folks who had been soldiers in the army before, career soldiers. They'd been soldiers in the army before the U.S. was called to war. They're members of the 24th Infantry, and they'd spent their careers, African Americans, out west, so fighting, basically fighting Native Americans or policing, keeping Native Americans off the land, or in the Philippines, administering American imperial holdings in the Philippines. So you have black people who are denied their citizenship, who are making their livelihood and staking their claim to the nation by doing the ugly work of American empire, right, which is interesting in and of itself, who are brought to Houston in 1917 to guard Camp Logan, the camp that they're building for during World War One. And there are all of these clashes between these soldiers who have a very strong sense of themselves as men, as representatives of the American government with their uniform, as people not to be messed with. And then they're encountering on the street, fighting with, clashing with the Houston police force and other people in Houston who are determined to make sure that they don't forget that however much they think they are men, they are still at the end of the day just black people. And they are to keep in their place. And the tensions that grow out of that, these sort of daily struggles, explode finally in late summer 1917 after a policeman, the sort of precipitating incident is that a policeman abuses a white woman, a black woman in the street in a black neighborhood. A soldier steps in to defend her. The policeman, the white policeman, assaults him, and the soldiers back in camp hear the story, basically, and just go nuts, and the town explodes. And these soldiers in camp decide to march on the town of Houston and get revenge, march on the police station and get revenge for their comrade, who some, you know, rumor says is dead, who people know has been unfairly assaulted and all of these other things. And the story, while dramatic, is also incredibly tragic, you know? So you have this sort of, you know, black civilians on the street, some cheering these soldiers on, some wondering what kind of Houston they're going to have to live in the aftermath. But for the most part, the soldiers involved in the riot end up summarily tried and many executed by the army. And at the end of the day, they've made a stand, which is great to talk about. But folks in Houston and soldiers in the Army aren't necessarily any better off than they were to begin with.
Mm-hmm. We're at our midpoint here. We have a caller we'll take right now here in Champaign County where we are, line one. Hello.
Hi. Speaking of World War One, just generally, you have a broad scope, so I thought it was appropriate to maybe mention this. It's you know, it was a controversial war at the time, obviously. Secretary of State Bryant resigned over it. It would have been as if Powell had resigned over the Iraq invasion, something like that. So and looking back on it, you know, it's sort of just, I don't think people have the full import of the controversy. But I wanted to ask if there was any interconnection between a later feature of sort of African Americans in the greater world, which would have been the intervention in Ethiopia, whether any of the people that, you know, saw Europe and saw a broader reality or something from the parochial thing that they'd been sort of consigned to by American power or the culture of the time, would have been alerted to the, you know, the anti-fascist campaign. We hear about the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, but we don't hear about the African American intervention against Mussolini in Ethiopia.
Well,
I think it's an interesting feature.
Oh,
so I gather you're ready to respond to that. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I'd say we hear about the Abraham Lincoln Brigade in part because the people who wanted to fight Mussolini in Ethiopia weren't allowed to. So African Americans joined the fight against Franco as a proxy for Ethiopia. They couldn't get to Ethiopia, and so they went to Spain. But what I did find as I was writing were letters from veterans of World War I writing to Haile Selassie saying that they were willing to volunteer their services. And one guy who I think was from Fort Worth who said, I'm a veteran of World War I. I have a group of black vets who are willing to come over there and fight with you for our Africa, right? So this, that he has the training and he somewhere along the way developed this diasporic consciousness where Ethiopia stands in for the African homeland that he still, that he then claims as his own. I think for a lot of people that happens through the United Negro Improvement Association. The UNIA and the Garvey movement. And so you have oodles of veterans pouring into the UNIA after World War I. And so this sort of nascent diasporic consciousness that they have coming out of the war then fuses with this self-consciously diasporic organization. And the fruits of that, I think, sort of come forth in the 1930s with the way that people respond to the fascist threat in Ethiopia.
Thank you. I thought there were some that actually did go, but I guess it wasn't under any official auspices or something.
I think it's not under official auspices. I'm not sure if there's some who do go or not. I mean, there's also interesting stories, too. In Chicago, Harry Haywood, who's a black communist, who whose real name was Haywood Hall and who was a veteran of World War I, helped organize these pro-Ethiopia rallies. And one of the people out there as part of this sort of broad swath didn't know Haywood wasn't a communist, but was part of this broad movement of African Americans protesting on behalf of Ethiopia was Katherine Johnson, who was one of three of the black YMCA secretaries who, female YMCA secretaries who served overseas during World War I. And she's out there in her YMCA cape wearing a poppy. So she's saying, I too am a veteran of this war, of World War I, and I am telling America where they need to defend democracy next, which I just love, actually.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Adrian Lent-Smith, is Assistant Professor of History at Duke University and is author of the book Freedom Struggles, African Americans and World War I, published by the Harvard University Press. Questions, welcome. Again, 333-9455. That's for local people here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455 and email will-talk@illinois.edu. We've been talking here about black men in the military. Were there women?
There were women who volunteered. I mentioned Katherine Johnson, Helen Curtis, and Addie Hunton as the three YMCA secretaries who volunteered. There were no Red Cross nurses because the Red Cross refused to take African American nurses. And then every once in a while, I would come across this really, you know, tantalizing stories in black newspapers or what have you that I could never follow up on, but including one about a woman who was discovered, I think a National Guard unit had mobilized, maybe in Chicago, and they'd made it to whatever camp they were going to. And among them was discovered a woman dressed up in men's garb, dressed as a man, trying to be part of this military unit. And the newspaper chalks it up to her trying to be close to her sweetheart, not that they name who the sweetheart is. But you could also imagine that she just wants to go to war and there's no other way for her to do it. I mean, there are other sort of logistical problems that would have arisen ultimately with that plan, but I do find it fascinating.
Can you talk a little bit more about relations between white soldiers and black soldiers and how that played out in Europe?
Yes. And it played out, well, there are the occasional stories. There's some nice stories about people who sort of find a camaraderie because they're all soldiers. But there are also a remarkable number of stories of sort of intra-army fighting between white and black soldiers. So many that I wondered when on earth they actually had time to fight the war. And a lot of those fights had to do with tamping down African Americans' expectations. Don't think that you're going to go back to the America after this is over and get treated like the French have treated you, because there was always this perception that the French were far kinder to African Americans than white Americans had been. And that was made much more explosive by the question of social equality, which is how people referred to interracial sex. Black soldiers sometimes had white French girlfriends, or hired white French prostitutes. And that became a way, again, to sort of perform their manhood, to defy Jim Crow. And it really set white sort of fellow soldiers, officers, army authorities, it really set them going. And so you see, I mean, vicious fights, riots, people beating each other up, MPs trying to assault people, soldiers who were thrown into the barracks because they were caught talking to French women on the street. And it's such an issue. It's an issue so deeply tied to politics and political access that Mississippi Senator James K. Vardaman refers to black soldiers who've gone overseas as French women ruined Negroes, right? Which is a term that I think is amazing in how it manages to offend so many people in such a compact space.
How did the black soldiers think about the fact that here they were, a very long way from home, serving on foreign soil, if not fighting, then certainly serving the interests of their country, where there was all of this rhetoric of defending and fighting for freedom, when in fact they weren't. They weren't free at home. They weren't free there. How did they think about that?
Some people became profoundly embittered. Rayford Logan, who would eventually return to the United States and become one of the most famous historians of African American history of the 20th century. But Logan, who had really gone into the war thinking of himself as sort of a member of W.E.B. Du Bois's talented 10th, right? Mm-hmm. You know, just I'm smarter than most. I'm good looking. I'm talented. I'm a soldier and a statesman and a scholar, and the world is going to see what I can do. Logan ended up saying that he fought two wars at once, Woodrow Wilson's war and his own war. And he was never sure which war had done what to him and how bad the damage had been. And Logan actually hated white Americans so much, he said, that he had stayed in Europe for 5 years after the war ended in 1919, basically to work through that animosity. He had to sort of exercise himself of that hate before he could return home. And I think for a number of other people, there was this sense that they had, in fact, earned their citizenship rights, and whether anyone wanted to give them to them or not, they were going to go home and start acting like they had them, right? And so a lot of the violence, there's this huge wave of reaction, of violence in the Red Summer of 1919, in which you get these sort of old-style race riots, which are really racial massacres led by white Americans in cities across the U.S. A lot of those race riots are responses to African Americans pushing back. And you have the lynching of soldiers in uniform, people who went back to whatever towns they came from and refused to take their uniforms off, even when they were ordered to do so, because those uniforms meant something to them and they signified something to other people, and they weren't going to relinquish the signs of their service and the signs of their merit without a fight.
So which one wondered which of those things came first, in a sense, whether the returning black soldiers were saying to whites in their communities, things are not going to be the way they were. Did that come first, or was there this anticipation, perhaps, of whites in those communities saying, when these men come back, one of the first things we have to do is demonstrate to them that, in fact, things have not changed from the way that they were, and that we're going to see to it that they don't?
I think that there's white supremacist or segregationist resolve to demonstrate to people that things have not changed, even before people come home. And you see that in military documents where even military authorities are worried about what's going to happen after the war. Well, we need to make sure that people understand that they're going back to the same communities that they left. But you also have, I mean, the other part of this that we haven't talked about are the black communities who stay behind, who decide before these guys are even gone that they're going to come back militant new Negroes, right? So you have the pastor in, I can't remember, some small town in Texas that tells the boys going off to war in a sermon, and when you come back from France, you were going to shoot the heck out of Jim Crow here in the United States. And we know that he said this because there are Bureau of Investigation files and military intelligence files of people who reported on him for saying it and worried about what they referred to as, quote, Negro subversion in the southern United States. And amazingly enough, you know, the Bureau of Investigation was new during World War I, and yet J. Edgar Hoover was already in place linking African American aspiration to foreign enemies, first German and then after the Russian Revolution to the Bolsheviks, as early as the 19-teens and early 1920s. Mm-hmm.
We are coming into about our last 10, 12 minutes in this part of Focus 580. Our guest, Adrienne Lent-Smith, is Assistant Professor of History at Duke University, and she is the author of a recently published book. The title of her book is Freedom Struggles, African Americans and World War I. It's published by the Harvard University Press. You talked just a little earlier about the kind of, that black soldiers were involved in maybe two kinds of fight. They were certainly involved in the fight of the war, and then there ended up being a lot of fighting between black soldiers and white soldiers in Europe, and that a lot of that had to do with what white soldiers saw black soldiers doing that they didn't particularly like, and a lot of that had to do with relations between black American soldiers and white European women. What sort of experiences did, black soldiers, to the extent that they had time off when they weren't having to do whatever it is they were assigned to do, what their lives were like in Europe?
They were better and more pleasant, and they, you have stories of people walking the streets of Paris and marveling both at the beauty of the city and the ways in which people either paid them no mind or were incredibly kind to them. And you have story after story, particularly in the black press, about how France is a land that knows no color line, knows no prejudice, that the goals of liberty, equality, and fraternity have truly been achieved here in France in a way that they have not in in the United States, which, when you think about it, and when you think that these guys, these African American soldiers, are moving around Senegalese or, French West African colonial subjects, North African colonial subjects, Indochinese colonial subjects, just seems sort of ridiculous, right? It's like France knows no color line. You have the evidence of French empire everywhere around you. And so I think that part of what's happening in the story's home is that it's a rhetorical, it's a political statement to white Americans about the failure of American democracy. So they're using France as a mirror, and in doing so, exaggerating how good France is on the one hand. But I also think that the French were genuinely more open to, more interested in, more kind to African-American soldiers than white American soldiers were or white Americans were. And the French were more kind to African-Americans than they were to their own African colonial subjects in a lot of instances. And I think it's because in some ways the American race problem, if you will, was not France's problem. Right? They had color lines to draw between colony and metropole, between the French in France and French colonial subjects, but they didn't have to figure out how to place African Americans, because at the end of the day, African Americans would largely, not wholly, but largely return back to the United States. And so they stood outside of that. Outside of that mm-hmm. dynamic.
Did many of the men who went there to serve decide to stay?
Some did. And you have this wonderful book, Perry Noir, by Tyler Stovall, that's about African Americans, I think the subtitle is, in the City of Light, right? The community, particularly in Montmartre, of black expatriates. And then there are people who come back. They might have gone home after the war, but they come back. A lot of those guys, or not a lot of them, but many of those guys are jazz musicians, because the regimental bands in the black regiments, particularly the famous 15th New York National Guard Regiment, they were jazz bands, and they sort of, their being overseas ignited this jazz craze in Europe. And so the guys who came out of those regimental bands, veteran soldiers, went home and told their other jazz musicians, you're making some money here in New York, but you can make three times that playing the same set in Paris. And so what you see are people going, this sort of cross-Atlantic traffic of people going because the war has taken these aspects of African-American culture and made them popular overseas.
We have a caller here, someone from the campus. Let's do that. Line one. Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
Very interesting. When the speaker was talking about the woman that dressed as a man to go with her man, reminds me of that song. I don't have the title, but I've sung it before, and I can recite a couple lines from it. The cruel war is Civil War era song. The cruel war is raging, and Johnny must fight. I long to be with him, both morning and night. I long to be with you. It grieves my heart so. Won't you let me go with you? No, my love, no. I'll wear men's clothing. I'll cut my hair short. I'll march as a comrade. No one will ever know. Won't you let me go with you? No, my love, no. Now, at the end of the song, he says, yes, my love, yes. So I just thought I'd add that because it was Peter, Paul, and Mary did it. Other people have done it. I've sung it at some Irish sessions around town, but it's a beautiful song. But I really enjoy what you're talking about.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. That, well, actually, when you mentioned that story, I'm thinking, has anyone done – there must be a book in this. Now, I'm sure that it would be a difficult research subject, but I would have to believe that throughout American history there would have been other women who would have done that or would have tried to do that, would have dressed as a man and wanted to gone off to war and tried to do that.
Yeah, that would be a great book.
I think so, too. It would surprise me that such a book doesn't already exist, or maybe the difficulty of doing that, of actually getting the information, the documentation that you would have to have I'm sure it would be a real serious challenge. Well, other questions indeed are still welcome. We have about 5 minutes left in this part of show with Adrienne Lentz-Smith. She's an historian at Duke University. We're talking here about her book, Freedom Struggles. It's about African Americans and World War I. Were there, now you were just talking about how some of the black soldiers who went were musicians, or the bands went with them, and that people there in Europe liked the music, and that maybe helped to get people in Europe excited about jazz and create opportunities for American musicians then to go and play in Europe. Were there other things that one can point to, ways in which culture in Europe was touched by the fact that there were these African Americans there for these years?
You know, I'm not sure. I think there was this kind of – there was this great emphasis in the 1920s in France on kind of primitivism, right, which was often read. And African Americans were swept up in that. You think about the popularity of Josephine Baker and this sort of dance with her skirt of bananas or whatever. African Americans were caught up in that and played to it, actually, in order to make a space for themselves. But I don't know if that's a product of African-American involvement in the war, of Antillean and African involvement in the war, or some combination of all of them. That's an interesting question.
I want to try to come back here. Now we just have a couple of minutes left again, to try to come back here kind of at the point where we started, again, to make the point about now these experiences that we talked about, experiences of black Americans who went to serve in the war, and of black Americans talking about service and talking about the war and what was at stake and what was going on here, how that, again, comes back and feeds into the civil rights struggle that then occurred there now for decades after the war.
Right. Well, I think there's a cohort of people that come out of the war who start thinking strategically about what it's going to take to really get citizenship rights. So you can point to the famous people who come out. I mentioned A. Philip Randolph, Rayford Logan, Charles Hamilton Houston, who was the architect of the NAACP's legal strategy to bring down Jim Crow. He trained Thurgood Marshall. But those guys, Logan and Hamilton especially, saw World War II coming on the horizon in the 1930s, and having been burned by doing something, you know, serving first and asking for reward later, began planning immediately for the deals they would make at the outset. We are going to serve loyally when you have given us X and Y and Z. You know, so they sort of put they do the groundwork for organizing that allows the movement to blossom during World War II and in its immediate aftermath. And I do think the civil rights movement actually begins in World War II, is crushed for a while by anti-communism, and then springs back up in the early 1950s, mid-1950s.
Now, and the as we've said here, the focus of this particular book is blacks in World War I. And an earlier caller talked about the fact that really desegregation, integration doesn't come to the military until after World War II, and that it was Harry Truman who really did that. I wonder if you've looked at all at the experience of World War II and whether that was essentially a replay of the World War I experience, or were there some important ways in which it was different?
It's largely a replay of the World War I experience, but the scale is even greater. What's the same is that it's African Americans proving their mettle against white Europeans as opposed to other people of color, which it had been in previous wars. But what makes World War II more effective, I think, is that the language of anti-fascism, which makes white supremacy a bad word for the first time, a bad term, is more effective than calling on, saying you're fighting a war for democracy, because what democracy is and who it includes is still up in the air.
Well, we're going to have to stop. We've come to the end of the time. It's an interesting story, and if people would like to read more, the book to look for is Freedom Struggles, African Americans, and World War I. It is published by the Harvard University Press by our guest, Adrienne Lentz-Smith. She is Assistant Professor of History at Duke University. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
I also want to say thanks to the technical director there at Duke for us this morning in this hour, Scott Wells. You've been listening to a program from the Focus Archives. Much of our local production, including past interviews from Focus and local news features, is available on our website anytime that you're ready to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for tuning in.
Shredding with some barbecue, feeling grand. Like all those people down in Dixieland.
On the next Fresh Air, a concert and interview with one of the best jazz and blues singers around, Catherine Russell. Join us.
I'd like to hear them play while I'm picking on a juicy rib. Oh, baby, strutting. Ain't it grand?
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
Support comes from Eastern Rug Gallery, offering over 1,000 contemporary and traditional guaranteed hand-knotted rugs made of pure wool or silk pile, from contemporary to traditional. Eastern Rug Gallery also offers a cleaning and repair service. Eastern Rug Gallery, located at 1402 South Neal Street in Champaign.
Our weather forecast today calls for increasing cloudiness, a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms late this afternoon, breezy, a near record high around 95. Tonight, mostly cloudy, a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms, the low 65, and tomorrow sunny, the high 85. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD3, Urbana.
Шутки.